Great. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It's really nice to be here. So today I'm going to talk about how toddlers can think for themselves. And I think within an education context, this might not be big news, but for developmental psychologists, this is quite divisive. Some people just think everything's social learning, which I'll be talking about. So for decades and decades in developmental psychology, it's all been about how toddlers, and not just toddlers, adults as well, learn from other people, social learning. And we know that, for instance, from about 15, 18 months, toddlers will imitate an intended action. So if you try to, for instance, put the bead thing in that cup and you miss, toddlers will actually correct it. They'll imitate strange actions. So if you turn on this light box with your head, toddlers will do that too. They'll hit it with their head rather than their hand, which would be much easier. Kids will over-imitate even if it's not necessary. So here we've got this puzzle box. It's clear. There's a prize in here. And the experimenter will poke a stick in the top and then poke it in the front to get a prize. Now, chimpanzees just ignore the top bit and go straight for the prize. But children up to 3 years will faithfully copy this. And they do this kind of extra step just because the adult did it. So young kids, we know robustly that they love to copy. This is a great way for them to learn. So I'm not saying this is not the case. But I think for decades, a lot of developmental psychology has forgotten that actually, you know, at some point in our lives, we have to think for ourselves. If you're an academic, if you're doing a PhD or a line of research, just copying someone else's paper is probably not the best thing to do. You have to come up with your own ideas, your own designs, your own writing. And so at some point, we're making this shift to not just copying, but thinking up our own ideas. And this is actually really important for humans for theories of cultural evolution. So linking culture to the same idea of biological evolution, people like Alex Masudi and Mike Tomasello have suggested that social learning is a lot like replication. So it's really important that once something's invented, that other people do it too. Because if I invent something and it goes nowhere, that's not really culture. That's just me doing something, right? But if the whole culture just did the same thing over and over and over again, that's not really evolution. And that's where you need variation, or what you might call in the cultural sense, innovation. So the reason we have nice big buildings and computers and everything else, that wasn't a product of copying over the years. It's probably a product of maybe coming up with new ideas, changing things, and so on. So it's really this bit that in toddlers hasn't really been investigated that much in developmental psychology. So I guess questions I've been asking is, do they just socially learn, or can they be independent thinkers as well, learn independently? And we're going to look at three different strands of research. So one is, can they make up their own jokes? Can they make up their own acts of pretending? And can young children do what is called divergent thinking? So this is just generating lots of different ideas. It's a type of creative thought. What do we even know about humor in toddlers? Not loads, but my past research found that at 15 months, infants seem to be able to match up humorous cues to humorous actions. So if I am talking normally and then I start stroking a cat, kids look about a normal amount of time. If I start stroking the cat on my head, they look a lot longer because it's unexpected. If I do the reverse, if I give humorous cues, and then I start stroking a cat on my head, they actually look at that less long than stroking the cat, because they're probably thinking, where's the joke? So they understand something about humor and cues and how that all works at 15 months. We also know that by 2 years, toddlers will copy weird actions, like putting a hat over your eyes, if you cue it with laughter, and they'll correct the same wrong action if you say something like whoops. So they can distinguish when you mean to joke and when you make a mistake. And there's also other research by Gina Moreau coming out that infants are understanding humor even in the first year, responding appropriately to strange acts by smiling at them, things like that. But a lot of this, a lot of the research that there has been, there's not loads of research on humor in early development, but the research that there has been about how do toddlers and infants respond to other people? What do they understand about other people's humor? Do they copy other people's humor? Things like that. But there hasn't really been much about what they do themselves. Can they make up jokes? Do they make jokes? What's going on there? So we know from observations and parent reports that it seems that two-year-olds are inventing jokes. So before 2 years, most parents would say that their kids are just copying them, and they're doing this even before a year. But by 2 years, they're like making up their own ideas. One problem with observations and parent reports, though, is that a parent, or in the case of parent reports, or someone like me in the case of a 10-minute observation, doesn't know all the history of the child's life. So what might look like a novel joke could be something they learned from grandma or at nursery or watching some TV show that you weren't watching with them. And so it's very hard to know. I mean, probably they're making up these jokes, but unless you've recorded everything the child's ever witnessed, you don't know for sure that these are inventions. And so that's why we have brought in an experimental paradigm to see if we can capture in an experiment what we're seeing in observations, what we think are novel jokes, and what parents are reporting. So in this experiment, we had preschoolers, toddlers, preschoolers, I don't know what you want to call them. They're 30 and 36 month olds, so 2.5 and 3-year-olds. And we wanted to put them in a situation where they would have to make up their own jokes to get a laugh, and they can't rely on past memories or information to do that, or it'd be very unlikely that they could. So we had two experimenters, one's our confederate, and we had six kind of normal toys which most kids 2.5 years will know the words for, according to the MacArthur-Bates CDI. So according to those norms, most kids know that that's a duck. And the experimenter says to the confederate, what do you want to call this? And the confederate, in the joke condition, will say something silly, like oogle-boo. And then everybody in the room laughs, both experimenters and the parent as well is in on the joke. We do six in a row, so the next thing might be a spoon, and then call out a wagaboo, and everybody has a good laugh, and so on. So we do six in a row. The children then have a chance to copy that. So this is not innovation. This is just imitation, social learning again. So we could then show them the duck. What do you want to call this? The kid might say, oogle-boo. But then critically, we bring out six more familiar objects, and we stop modeling. So let's say we bring out a toy pig. We haven't told them the joke. If they want to keep getting laughs, now they're on the spot to say something silly. It's unlikely that they've seen somebody label a pig something silly in the past. This is a very specific instance. So they have to think on their feet if they want to do well on this task. We have a control condition, so half the kids. It's just kind of this weird situation, quite frankly, where we mislabel the object. And they go, there, all right, okay. And we're all kind of happy, but it doesn't make any sense because that's a duck. And then we give the kids a chance to try with the six. And what we might expect in this case is, because we're not intending to joke, we might expect the kids to say, like, that's a duck, and that's a spoon, and sort yourselves out. And because the intention's not there, we would expect in our control condition that, you know, why would they make up a joke? They're just going to correct us and tell us they know what the words are. So what we found was that, I'm just focusing on two conditions because there's this whole kind of crossed with foreign languages and stuff. If anyone's interested, you can ask me about that later. But in our English language condition, English humor condition, and then we had this control condition, we're all saying, yeah, all right, there, it's great. We find a difference. And that's quite important. So what we found is that children were significantly more likely to come up with some silly word for the object if it was in a joking context compared to if it was in this kind of sincere, positive context that wasn't about jokes. So first of all, at least 50% of the time, they can come up with their own jokes. They're coming up with these things that they've probably never heard before. And they're not just randomly saying weird things. They understand that it's the context of a joke because they're doing it much more than here. So these are, in this condition, this is what the breakdown of words were. 71% were nonsense words like what we gave. So one kid called a cup a guju-buju. That was not a word we ever used in the experiment. And one possibility is that last week grandma called a cup a guju-buju and he remembered it and is saying it here. But that seems really unlikely that this perfect scenario has occurred for this to happen. 19% were wrong words, so one kid called a brush a spider monster, which is kind of metaphorical. 10% was playing with the right words, so calling a block a blocky block. I guess And I guess another thing to point out is that even though they had a chance to copy six of these jokes, no one ever copied the jokes. And the thing about two-year-olds and six items in a row is that it's beyond their working memory capacity. It was easier for them to invent a new joke than to remember what we said. So actually, it's easier to innovate than remember and imitate in this case. So we just collapsed the data from the model trials and the extension trials because they literally never copied the joke. I think one more thing to point out, though, is that in these kinds of experiments, you're looking at the difference between conditions, can they tell what the intentional context is, but this is still 50%. In experiments we did before with imitation, that bar tends to be about 75%. And this is probably, we didn't look at it in the study, but it's probably about half the kids are doing this, and maybe half the kids aren't, or something like that. So even though they are capable of doing it, they're capable of inventing jokes at 2 years, just like their parents are reporting. In this task, it is quite hard, and it is harder than copying. So we wanted to look at this in terms of pretending as well. I think people often think of pretending as the gateway to the imagination. Once you can pretend, you can do anything. So if I can do object substitution, this could be a hat, it could be a paddle, if I was going canoeing, I don't know, it could be a mitten, it can be whatever you want. Isn't that amazing? So there's no limitations. So we think of it as very imaginative. But and we do see in free play, so again with observation, that children are using object substitution, so this kind of uses one object as another. But again, the problem with free play is we don't know what's happened before. We don't know if this is deferred imitation, if kids are enacting things they've seen other kids do or their parents do. There have been lots of experiments about pretending, but 2 and 3 year olds again are good at object substitution in these contexts, but they basically tend to be imitation tasks. So I say, oh, it's a hat, and then can you do it? Can you pretend? And they put it on their head, and it's a hat. That's important, and I'm sure they learn a lot of pretending from other people, but that's not really imaginative from the child's point of view if they're just copying you. And you could even argue, do they even understand necessarily what's going on, or are they just copying you? Do they really get that it's pretending? The other thing that happens in a lot of these experiments is using direct instructions. So you might not show them what to do, but in one probably quite well-known study by Harris Kavanaugh, is a whole monograph following kids with lots of experiments, is they don't use imitation, but they use direct instruction. So show me how you stir Teddy's tea with the spoon. They give them a cup and a stick. And they say, stir their tea with a spoon. Well, even without imagining richly that there's tea and everything else, you've just been told to stir, and there's a stick and a cup. That probably looks like a spoon and a cup. So again, it's kind of, they're being told what to do. They don't have to invent this on their own. And again, it's also debatable whether they fully understand that representation in this context or whether they're just following physical instructions with motor actions. So we used a really similar setup to the last experiment, but we ended up working with three-year-olds, or actually older three-year-olds, because we tried this with two-year-olds and they failed miserably. So we basically got to an age where there was any hope of them doing this. And to remind you, kids are showing object substitution from 2 years and free play and stuff, but to contrast it with our findings, even younger three-year-olds are not great at, in our experiment, coming up with their own pretending. So we have model phase and then extension phase. So in the model phase, they can just copy, just like has happened with lots of experiments. So the experimenter says, let's pretend that the hairbrush is this. And then they whack the hairbrush on the table. They smile, they make a sound effect, bang, 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 make lots of eye contact. So these things are things that we know that parents do when they're pretending with their kids. So we wanted to make it kind of more naturalistic as it can be in an experiment. And then there you see, I was pretending it was this, giving lots and lots of clear information that we're pretending. And then they have a chance, they've got the hairbrush. They might brush their hair if they don't know what's going on, or they might start banging it on the table. But that's not innovation yet. That's not coming up with their own ideas. So we do 4 trials like that, and then we have 4 trials where we stop showing them what to do. So we've given them the idea of the task, but now we're not going to show them. They have to figure it out on their own. So now can you try and pretend? What could you pretend it is? So we give them the shaker, We show them a picture of a shaker and a pen. And this is like to just kind of make it a bit easier for them to generate an idea. We're giving them something very clear to use if they want to. So they could shake it, because that's what you do with a shaker. Or you could start writing. They could also do something else, but I don't think they really did. I think if they ever pretended, they just went with the other object that was there. And we have not shown them this. Okay, and we don't point to the pen or anything like that. They kind of have to infer this. Again, we have a control condition for half the children. Let's try and use the hairbrush like this, but this time we have this person who's just kind of incompetent. And they start banging on the table, and they pointed at the hairbrush this time, banging on the table. They're confused, there's no sound effect, there's less eye contact. And they say, whoops, I did it wrong. I was not using it like this. Give the children a chance. And what we'd expect is if they understand the difference between pretending and trying, they should, in this case, just start brushing their hair. They shouldn't be banging it on the table. If they're just blindly copying the whole time, then maybe they will just bang it on the table. Maybe they just don't even understand what the pretending's about. And the extension trial, show them the shaker, show them the pictures. Can you try and use it? How would you use it? And we might expect this time they'll just shake it because they understand the intention is just to do normal stuff. Okay. And so here's what we found. White bar is when is the pretend condition. So we've used words like pretend, eye contact, sound effects, pointed at the pretend object. And this dotty bar is the trying condition. So where the person's kind of acting weirdly and incompetently. And again, what's first of all important is this difference. So what we find is that when children have a chance to copy, they copy about 70% of the time in the pretend condition compared to about 30% when it's trying. So they can tell the difference in these contexts. They're very happy to copy pretending. And it's not that they're blindly copying. They understand that you just do that when it's pretending. Now we have the same pattern in our extension trials where now they've not seen anything. They have to come up with the idea on their own. So again, they're understanding the difference between conditions. They're not just blindly using one object as the other. But again, I want you to notice that this has really dropped. This is about 40% now. And it was about roughly half the kids who actually ever generated any novel pretending. So again, this is kind of mixed results. Seems that these older three-year-olds are capable of inventing their own pretending. And again, it's very unlikely that they've used a shaker as a pen before or something like that where they could just remember that they saw someone do that last week because we've really put them on the spot. But it is difficult. It is more difficult than copying. And it's not all the kids, right? Part of that's going to be this experimental context. Maybe some kids are shy or whatever else. They weren't really that shy here, right? So it is this, they can do it, but it is difficult. So now we're going to be moving on for the rest of the talk to look at divergent thinking. And this is something that might be underpinning what's going on in the other studies, although I think actually we found it probably doesn't. And this is this general idea that you can generate several ideas within a problem space. Divergent thinking has been studied since the 50s. Loads and loads of studies with adults and with children from 3 years upwards over the decades. One of the original tests is the Wallach and Kogan test of creativity, which people use as young as 4 years. And there's an instances test. So you can have audience participation. What are things you can think of that are round? Any ideas?
Pebbles.
Sorry?
Pebbles,
great. Anything else? Ball? Huh? Marble, great. Sorry?
The moon.
Yeah, so that's a divergent thinking score of 4, 4 different things. Now, if you just kept saying ball, 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 you'd get a score of 1. If you said ball, knife, computer, you'd probably get a score of 1. So basically, you have to come up with lots of different ideas, but they still have to fit the question, right? Pattern meaning test. What could that picture be? Any ideas? Sun, okay.
Explosion.
An explosion, yep. Sorry?
An open book.
An open book, yeah.
Hedgehog.
Hedgehog, and what was the other one?
Porcupine.
Yeah, the porcupine, yeah. Okay, so same idea, but using a picture, okay. Now, the problem with this is that you're going less than 4 years, Kids under 4 years, they're not that verbal. There's some of them are, but there's a lot of variation. They're not going to necessarily even understand what your question is. So Torrance in 81 developed the thinking creatively in action and movement task. And it's basically generating ideas, but in a physical way. So you don't have to come up with lots of words. So one of the tasks is they put tape here, let's say in here, and they show them two ways to walk to go across the room. So it might be like hopping. That's not probably skipping, I don't know. And then like running, and the kids can copy that, and then they say, how else can you move across the room? So the kids might crawl, or do some kind of crab walk, or do forward rolls, or something like that. And all the different ideas they generate, that's their divergent thinking score. And we tried this with two-year-olds, and it just doesn't work. So what happens is they copy the first two actions, and then they just keep doing those actions. And there's a few different reasons we think this might have been. One is that we looked at the MacArthur-Bates CDI and only 50% of two-year-olds understand the word same, and different wasn't even on this list of 400 words. So I think they probably didn't even understand the instructions. Another possibility is their inhibitory control is really bad. They can't stop themselves from doing something right in front of them. So maybe once you showed them something, they just have to keep doing it. They just can't, they're not going to stop and do something else. They're like, okay, I just have to run across. That's what they showed me. So that's another possibility. So my PhD student, Simone Vandenberg, I've left off part of her name there, and I, but really mostly her, developed the unusual box test. So we're trying to like get away from the verbal demands, get away from the inhibitory control demands, and come up with a test where kids could just explore, generate lots of ideas, don't have to understand representation or anything else, and see if they can't think divergently. Because up to this point, we just don't know if kids under three could. There's no way to capture that. So this task, it's got like a hole, some stairs, some room here. We've got these rings, ledges, strings. And so there's all these different bits. We put it on a turntable to make it easier for the kids to get to the different sides of the box. And we just give them strange objects one at a time for 90 seconds each. They basically come from hardware stores, pet shops, and kitchen stores. So things they wouldn't really know what they are. We wanted things that might have different affordances to get them exploring a bit more. And all we really do is give them the box, the object, and just after we've shown them the different sides, just so they realize there are different sides, and just let them play. How do we code divergent thinking? Painfully using a spreadsheet like this. The easy part is what part of the box are they using? So maybe they're hitting in the hole or in the square room or on the stairs. That's usually pretty easy to identify. We also came up with a bunch of actions they might do in combination to the part of the box. So jumping, which is actually very similar to walking. I'd like to collapse those. Hitting it, just touching the box. Turning things on the box, all these kinds of things. And that gets a bit harder to code. And you just watch the video, and you wait till they do something, and then you put a one where it crosses. And at least once you've done that, if they do it again, you can ignore it. Because we don't care how many times they do it, we just care about how many different action box area combinations they come up with. And our little spreadsheet gives us a number so we don't even have to count ourselves over here. And that's their divergent thinking score. So I'll show you a video of what this looks like when a kid's playing. So here it's probably guide through hole, so she gets 1 point. Turn the box, gets another point. Drops it on the stairs, gets a third point, okay? Okay, so how do we know this is divergent thinking versus random? So there is a couple things we did. We do have in 3 and 4 year olds, certainly in 3 year olds, we have the TCAM measure. And in 4 year olds, at least, we have the Wallach and Kogan we can compare it with. And what we can do is see, are they getting similar results in our test as the other ones? But we don't want to stop there, because then we just have another measure that you can use with kids over two. So we tested 1 and 2 year olds using test, retest, reliability. There are no other tests to compare it to. So we just see, do they get similar scores at time one, and then 2 weeks later at time two? And do they engage with it? Are they just sitting there doing nothing? Is the average score one? Is anything happening? So these are the 3 and 4 year olds. They came up with, on average, 24 different action box area combinations. So they are It's over 7.5 minutes. So they are coming up with lots of ideas. And we see this is an individual differences measure. We're seeing a lot of differences here. So one kid's come up with 8 combinations. Another one's 34. So that's, I think, 4 times as many action box area combinations. So that's good. But does it correlate with the other tasks? It correlates very well with the instances task. This is controlling for age. So that is how many things are round. It controls very well with the TCAM. I mean, 0.6, these are very different tests. This one's verbal, you know, and it's correlating with our just like explore an object one. This one you might expect to correlate better because it's more action-based. But they're very different tasks, and they're correlating very well. And then the instances and the TCAM also correlate very nicely, controlling for age. The pattern task, the pattern meanings task, just didn't really correlate with anything. So I think it's just not a good task for 3- and 4-year-olds. They have 4 trials on this, and the average score is 5.8. So on like 2 trials, they're coming up with 1 idea. And that's not really in the spirit of divergent thinking, where it's about generating lots of ideas. So I think actually, probably don't want to use that with young kids at all. But what's nice is our task works, but actually these are really good too. And I'd suggest if you're working with certainly 4-year-olds, possibly 3-year-olds, this is the easiest one to do. It's also nice because I don't even know if these people have correlated their tasks to anything else before. As far as I know, they just said, ta-da, it's a divergent thinking measure. And they don't intercorrelate them. But actually, they are capturing the same thing despite the very different ways they're tested. So that's great. So we have another task for 3- and 4-year-olds. Does it work for younger kids? Yes. So at time 1, our 2-year-olds came up with 19 action box area combinations on average, so lower than the 3- and 4-year-olds, but still generating lots of ideas. Again, a very nice range, 10 to 32, so lots of individual differences. At time 2, no significant difference. They're coming up with 20 on average. Again, a nice range, 12 to 36. And when we correlate them, the scores are really highly correlated, 0.8. We just looked at the total things. They might be repeating some of the actions, but with the 1-year-olds, because reviewers suggested it and it was a very good idea, I don't think I have it here, but we did just look at the unique actions at time 1 and time 2, and you get the same kinds of results. So if you just take out the repeated ones, it's not just that they're just doing the same set. Well, they are doing the same set to some extent, but it still correlates when you take those out. So our 1-year-olds, again, fewer than the older kids, so 16 on average at time 1. Again, a very nice range, 6 to 28. Almost 17 at time 2, no difference between time 1 and time 2. And this time, actually, motor age mattered more than age. And I think when they're 1, they have fewer motor skills. I think when they're 2, motor age doesn't really matter anymore. We didn't really find anything. When they're 1, there's a lot of variation in, you know, how much they can pick things up and all that. So controlling for that, again, we get a good correlation between time 1 and time 2, 2 weeks apart. So it seems like it works as young as 1 year. Toddlers as young as 1 year can think divergently. It's not just random actions, because it correlates with other divergent thinking tests in 3- and 4-year-olds. I think that's really important. And it's really the first evidence, we may not have creative thought, but it's certainly of divergent thinking in toddlers. So this is starting really early. This is around the same time that kids are copying people. It's happening at the same time, but it's just kind of being ignored. And actually, yes, it'll come up now. So I've kind of polarized social learning and independent thought like they're these two different things. And I think a lot of people conceptualize that. There are computational models that suggest that you're either an innovator or an imitator. You know, we must be different types of people. But actually, in the first 2 experiments I showed you with the joking and pretending, we kind of got them to innovate based on social, like modeling something in the first place, right? Like if we'd just gone to the innovation trials and said, joke, here's a duck. I'm guessing most kids, I'm guessing that 50% of kids were not going to start saying guju buju, right? So we actually did some kind of social learning within that, and they used that to extrapolate and come up with their own thoughts. So the question here is, actually, could divergent thinking be socially learned? Does it have to be completely independent, or is this kind of rotating, iterating process? Now, there's research by some people which says, no, if you show kids what to do, they will stop exploring. And in these kinds of experiments, they'll have In this case, a puzzle box. In this case, like a fun toy where you like press a button and a light comes on or makes a sound or something like that. And if you just let them explore, they'll come up with lots of ideas. If you show them, if you press the button first, or you put a stick in the slot first or something like that, the kids will just do that and only that, and they don't explore anymore. So that would suggest, you know, if you're going to show them what to do, they're going to stop exploring. But in research with adults, well, I talked about joking and pretending, but also research with adults, if adults do a divergent thinking test in a group first and then do another divergent thinking test on their own, they come up with way more ideas. So there's something about learning from the group, maybe how to think divergently or the kinds of ideas they can generate, so it's actually beneficial. If you see good examples of creativity from other people, again, you come up with better creative solutions yourself. And I think the difference between these bodies of research is that it's not that you're modeling, it's what you're modeling. Here, you are modeling very bad divergent thinking. You're modeling one action on an object and then telling the kids, now it's your turn. You're basically, you might be kind of implying that that's what you do with the object. Here, people are modeling really good divergent thinking, a high level of creativity. And so when the person, it's their turn, maybe they know they have permission to do this and they're given clues on how to do this. So we thought, well, maybe if you show lots of divergent thinking, a high level of divergent thinking, kids will pick up on that and come up with more divergent thinking themselves, either through coming up with new ideas based on what they've seen or through permission. And if you just show them, let's say, one action, a low level of divergent thinking, we thought that would limit their divergent thinking, just like they found. In a broader sense, if you can imagine a parent who's around their kid all day, if this is the case, then we would expect parents' divergent thinking to correlate with children's. So let's say a parent has a towel, and they're like, this can be a cape, this could be a nice hat, we can use it as a blanket, and they're modeling in day-to-day life divergent thinking, then kids might pick up on that we're allowed to do it and how to do it. And so those kids might have better divergent thinking themselves. Conversely, if a parent is like, don't use that towel as a cape. You should dry your body and do nothing else. And if that's their style, then their kids might not realize they're allowed to use objects in different ways, and they might not have a model of how to do that. So in one of our studies with the one-year-olds, we had parents do this divergent thinking task where you just fill in circles. And the more different ideas you come up with, that's the higher score. So here we have an apple, a girl, Mickey Mouse, and a ball, so that's a score of 4. You could have somebody else who like fills this whole thing up and gets a score of 30 or whatever. We had a lot of, this one was done in Scotland, so it was a lot of Scottish breakfasts, I think, were featured on here. So parents do that test, kids do the unusual box. Completely different test. We did choose this so at least it wasn't verbal, so it would be visual. Different people doing different tests. And it correlates. So what we found was it's a 0.4 correlation, which is really not even bad within the same person across different tests or across people with the same test, again, controlling for motor age. So what we found was that parents and toddlers' divergent thinking do correlate at 1 year. And so it might be the social learning thing. Of course, you might think maybe this is just genetics. They share half of their genes. And that's a possibility. And in fact, there have been genes identified mostly in like the dopamine areas of the brain, where if you have a certain variant, you tend to score higher on divergent thinking. But these account for very small proportions of variation. And the twin research that was from the 70s actually found that there was like nothing there. So monozygotic twins just didn't, their results didn't correlate any better than dizygotic twins. And so there's a bit of a confound between here. And it might be that this can find these kind of smaller effects that you're not finding in twins. There's something genetic, but it's probably not going to account for like 44% of the variation. And so that's why I would say that social learning is probably the more likely component. But to be more confident of that, we ran another experiment. And this way, with experiments, you can't really look at it causally. Here, we could put children in different conditions and see how the environment changed the children's responses. So we had 85 two-year-olds across 4 conditions. The baseline is just the regular unusual box test. We just give it to them and let them go, so no influence whatsoever. We had a low divergent thinking modeling condition with low activity. So basically, I'll show you some videos, but The experimenter models one action with each object and then lets the kid play. And we thought this would make them just do that and not explore. We have low divergent thinking modeling high activity conditions, so they do the same thing 5 times, and that's going to be with the object. I thought that would make them like explore even less, because you're like, it's kind of like saying this is what you do with this object. And then this is an important one. We model 5 different actions with each object before it's the child's turn. Remember, their working memory is terrible at 2 years. It's something like 2. So to copy all of those is probably going to be pretty hard. But this is giving them ideas about things they might do with the box, and it's also potentially giving them permission to try different things. And we thought then the scores would go up here. Okay, so this is low divergent thinking modeling. So she shakes the egg cup thing in the hole. And look, he kind of copies that, I don't know. he's doing something similar anyway. Okay. Here's high divergent thinking. You'll see she has to look, it's so even hard for her working memory, she has to look at her cheat sheet to remember all the actions. So really highlighting lots of different features of the box, lots of different actions, and just showing. So here she's just copying the last one at this point, right? So what happens? This is our baseline. Kids came up with 20 different action box combinations, which is the same as in our original study. Here is basically where they show one action. And it goes down a little bit to 18, but it's not significantly different. So actually, it didn't negatively impact it like past research. They just kept exploring. And I think that might just be the function of the design of the box. There were no flashing lights. There was no prize. And they have a minute and a half. So you know, maybe in that kind of constraint, they think, OK, it's not just social learning. When we showed the same action 5 times, same as here, about 20. But where we did find a significant difference was in our high divergent thinking. So we're modeling 5 different actions per object, 5 objects, that's 25 across the study. These don't include the ones they copied. So in fact, they have a penalty. They can't even get points for 25 of the actions, whereas they could get them here. But they come up with, on average, about 24 compared to 20. That's like a 20% increase. So by showing them lots of different things to do with this object, it's not that they're just blindly copying that and they stop doing other actions on their own. They actually come up with more ideas. And it might be permission. It might be that they're like, oh, there are strings over there that person's highlighted, and I'll do something different with them. They copied on average, I think, about 4 actions in this condition, about 1 in each of these. So they weren't even copying that much. They had 25 actions they could copy, and they're copying about 4 of them. So it really seems that in using this box, kids are, they're quite keen in general to think independently, but social learning doesn't diminish their response, it increases their independent thought, so they can learn to do that. So modeling a low level of divergent thinking had no effect, they explored just as much as if they saw nothing at all. Modeling a high level of divergent thinking increased their own divergent thinking, even though they were penalized, even if they happened, if they would have come up with some of those actions they saw on their own, we took those points away. And so children might be picking up on the intention to explore or permission or learning about the objects, features, and affordances. And I would say this could explain the correlation between parents and toddlers is a bigger effect size than what we see in the genetics research. And I also think that in future, this might be a possible divergent thinking intervention. So one of the goals across the curriculum in England is creativity, getting kids to think independently. This might be one way of encouraging it. I mean, you have to do a larger scale study with controls and all these kinds of things. But this might be in different contexts, not just with a box, but with literature, with math, with anything else. Maybe you could do something like that. So, I don't have much time left, but I'm getting to the end. I'll just tell you a little bit about current research going on in my lab, but it's kind of unfinished stuff or just getting submitted. My former PhD student, Birsu Kandamirsi, she's interested in creativity. And originally, she was really interested in terms of touch screens and creativity. Apparently, if you use a touch screen to do a creativity task, you don't do it any differently than if it's not on a touch screen. But the interesting thing came out was that when kids work in pairs, They show more higher divergent thinking scores, higher creativity scores using another measure as well, than when they're working on their own. This is across both the UK and Turkey, and it's across both drawing and storytelling, so different forms of creativity. And so again, it gets at this idea that social learning might be important. So for the drawing task and the other task, the drawing task, they have one pencil, so it's not like they're both drawing. They have to take turns, but together they're coming up with more ideas. I also have one that's going to probably be in prep forever because it's a null result and one study. But basically, we had 1 to 3-year-olds do the unusual box test and do an imitation task, and there was zero correlation. So this idea that you're an imitator or an innovator, at least we didn't find that with these kids. There's just absolutely no relationship. We're now developing a parent report measure of creativity that includes both problem solving and novelty seeking for kids between 1 to 3 years. If you have a child between 1 to 3 years, you can go do our surveys. And right now, we've got a battery of surveys. If you do them now, and again in 6 months, you get a 5-pound Amazon voucher. The website might come off and go back on this week for maintenance, but I think it's on right now. and so here, it's a parent report measure. And we're just really trying to see, can we capture different creative thought processes by asking parents about their kids' everyday life? My PhD student, Stephanie Powell, has an ESRC studentship. She's looking at the effects of touchscreens on toddlers' problem solving and creativity. And we're actually finding, surprisingly, that problem solving seems to correlate well with using educational apps. Very preliminary. We want to follow this up with experiments to see actually if we do a problem-solving app, do kids do better on an unrelated problem-solving task? Does it prime them to think that way? And I've currently got a British Academy mid-career fellowship looking at a similar question. Do touch screens affect children's ability to, part of it is invent novel jokes and pretending. So can they learn to joke or pretend in a touchscreen app and then transfer that to the real world? We found, again, with our surveys that it seems that there's a positive correlation between watching children's TV and using educational apps and children's development of joking and pretending. That's not specific to inventing jokes and stuff. So we'll see if it does that as well. And that is it. So thank you very much.